Calling it friendship made it possible to tell Heath.
That's a lot,
Heath says gently, his eyes soft with concern.
I take it that's not easy for you.
It's fine. I make light of it since I don't want to scare him away.
Joe, it's not fine. I can tell it's not fine. You don't have to paint it over for me.
Already he can see through my veneer. No point pretending. My shoulders relax a bit. You're right. It's not fine. But it still just is. It's life. It's what happened.
How did that come about?
He clearly asks out of concern for me, not for the salacious details, so I tell him the story. I met Poppy my freshman year at Yale. She was an art history major too, and we bonded instantly over a love of Caravaggio and J.M.W. Turner, of Rothko and de Kooning. She was from England. I grew up on the East Coast. I came from a small family of academics. It was just my mom, dad, and me. She had a big one with six brothers and sisters. We were from different places, but we became thick as thieves, passionate about art and learning and boys and sex. Those words come easily, but they're only the start. I rearrange my fork and knife, trading their spots at the table, bracing myself for the next part. When my mother was sick with cancer, Poppy was there with me. She came with me when I went to my mom's treatments. She was there, too, when my mom died.
I'm so sorry you lost your mother, Joe,
he says with sympathy, and maybe even a shared pain. Thank you. She was amazing. She was my hero.
And she believed in you,
he says. He'd been listening when I said my mom told me I could do anything.
What was she like?
That's easy to answer. Vibrant. Curious. She believed in books and questions and taking chances and having faith in yourself. And hard work. Most of all, she believed in the value of hard work.
She left her mark on you,
he says, his eyes locked with mine. It's as if we're alone in the restaurant, the clinking of dishes from the kitchen, the chatter of other diners, the footsteps of the staff have all faded away. It's just him and me, and he gets me completely. She did. I shrug, owning it when I say, I'm a lot like her. I have a photo of her in my flat. I'll show it to you sometime.
I'd like that,
he says. These little things, showing the picture, meeting TJ, all feel like inevitabilities, even though they can't be. Unless we truly do become friends. And friends share the hard truths. The first year after was rough. I threw myself into my studies. Mom always encouraged me to pursue my dreams, and I knew I wanted to work in art and that I'd need a master's degree. But work and learning became so much more for me than just a professional requirement. I thumped my fist on my sternum. Studying art helped me heal. Maybe that sounds weird.
Not at all, he says without pause. Not one bit.
It's easy to talk with Heath. He seems enrapt, and I don't think it's because I'm a great troubadour, unspooling oral history. I think it's him. He likes to listen. And as part of grad school, I went to London that summer to study. Several months after Mom passed. Poppy lived here then, studying for her master's. She invited me to stay with her family, and when I dated a grad school student, I told her all about him. We talked about everything, including the guys we saw. Soon, she started telling me about a new man she was seeing. She didn't use his name. I keep my tone even as I hit the spot where the tale starts to twist. She was deliberately veiled. And she'd say, soon, I'll tell you soon. She said she'd fallen for someone and to trust her choices. Memories play out in my mind. The days I spent here in London, still trying to find a way out of a cloud of grief, needing my people, like Poppy, my father, and Jacob. Heath keeps his gaze on me, his deep brown eyes patient, kind.
That's a lot to ask,
he says softly. Yes, it was. And unfair. I gird myself for the final chapter. One day after a seminar, I had some errands near Hyde Park, and I found her with my father on a park bench, wrapped up in each other. I look away, letting the image pass, then returned to my dinner companion. And it turned out they'd been together for some time. He draws a sharp breath.
Did it start while your mother was ill?
He asks carefully, almost bracing himself for a yes. That's the one saving grace, I suppose, that I can say no. It didn't start then. My father was with my mother the whole time, caring for her. I was around then too, and Poppy was often with me. They say it started shortly after my mother died. For a while, after I found out about them, I obsessed over every detail of how it had happened. And when I looked back on those days, that made sense. Which also meant it had been going on for months before I caught them. They'd lied to me that entire summer while we were all here. I confronted them after seeing them in the park, and they said they didn't want to tell me until they knew they were going to marry. Like that would erase the months of lies. Like the sanctity of love was enough, I say bitterly. His lips curl in disgust.
It's terrible they deceived you. It's better just to be honest, even about transgressions like that.
I don't think I'd have liked it either way, but yes, exactly. I felt so stupid, like I didn't matter to either of them. My voice is brittle, my jaw ticks. And sure, they didn't start dating until Mom was gone, but they got to know each other while she was sick. The memory of their deception is a noose choking me. I try to loosen it, to tug free of the past. I hate when it trips me up. I refuse to let it. I have to deny its power. And so my best friend had a secret affair with my father after my mother passed, and they lied about it for nearly a year. Now she's his wife. London reminds me of them. Of lies. Heath reaches a hand across the table, takes mine in his, squeezes my palm.
That's so hard, Joe,
he says gently. I whisper my thanks. I thought I was so tough. I thought I could handle their secrecy and now their marriage. But it was easier to hate the scene of the crime than deal with them. I wasn't able to talk to them after. I haven't spoken with her since then, and I barely talk to my father now. I fan my face like that will dry the tears welling in my eyes. I guess it's taking more emotion than I thought. He squeezes harder. Reassurance seems to flow from him to me, and I need his calm, need his resilience. I reach for the napkin in my lap to dab at my cheeks. I'm sorry. He shakes his head, his brows knit.
Don't apologize for having feelings. It's complicated and terrible, and of course it must have made you doubt everything. Your friendship with Poppy, your sense of the truth, your sense of people.
Yes, that. He gets it exactly. He sees why the news rocked my world. I'm an only child. Over the course of a year, I lost the person I loved most in my mother, the friend I depended on like a sister, and the trust and faith I'd put in my father. I felt so alone, I say, my voice small and wobbly. The waitress appears with our food, a fattoush salad for me and a hummus plate for him. We thank her, and once she's gone, Heath doesn't make a move to pick up his fork. He just holds my hand tighter and listens. Since, evidently, I'm not done. Maybe I needed to tell this story again. I haven't spoken about it in years. Easton, Emerson, TJ, Nolan, they simply know it. I threw myself into work, into friendships, into New York, and into hating London, I say. When I finished grad school, I moved to New York City, and I felt like I was remaking myself. I moved into a tiny apartment with no windows. It smelled like sauerkraut, but it was mine, and I was starting my own life. I found new friends, and they became my new family. At last, I smile. So, maybe the story has a happy ending after all.
Seems it does.
With a soft sigh, he threads his fingers through mine.
And no wonder you miss New York.
My chest squeezes tight with emotion. I do miss it. And them. That's why London is complicated.
Will you see them while you're here? Your father and his wife?
My jaw tightens. My teeth click. I'm seeing him on Sunday. I don't know if I want to see her.
That's understandable. And, for better or for worse, he's family, so perhaps it's easier to see him only.
I suppose so, I say. My gaze rests on our hands, locked together on a Friday night as I tell him about the soap opera period of my life. The best part is, he doesn't judge the fact that 10 years later, I'm still unsure how I feel about my father and Poppy.
Thank you for telling me about them, he says, and what it all means to you.
I don't usually tell men on the first date, I reply, with a sparkle of returning levity.
Oh, this is a date now.
Heath asks it like a challenge. A good challenge.
I thought we were just friends.
It's so just friends, coincidentally dining, I say, as I pick up my fork and dive in.
It definitely seems to be,
he says, a little hint of a smirk in his lips. After I take a bite, I choose more honesty. You know, Heath?
Yes, Joe?
You keep doing this thing.
What thing?
Where I think I miss New York, but you come near, and I don't miss it at all. His smile is electric, 5,000 watts.
Bet I could make you like London after all.
I take another bite of my salad, chew, then set down the fork. Is that a challenge? He lifts his water glass, drinks, then leans closer, his elbows on the table.
Perhaps it is. You said your friends are trying to get you to like it. What's their plan?
They gave me a book. Most Instagrammable spots in London. I've been checking them out and taking photos. He cringes visibly, and it cracks me up. Oh, excuse me, what is wrong with that? He sighs, sounding so aggrieved.
Let's see. Peggy Portions, Tower Bridge with you holding it, the London Eye.
He stops, stares levelly across the table.
I could go on.
Oh, please, that won't be necessary. I can smell your disdain from here. He laughs buoyantly, his eyes crinkle with laugh lines.
Good. Just wanted to be clear.
You're crystal.
Look, what's the point in Portions? The food is mediocre. It doesn't deserve to be photographed just because it's pink. And Tower Bridge is lovely, but there are other prettier bridges that aren't so crowded. And if you're in mad love with Ferris wheels, I'll take you on the London Eye. But if you're not, why bother? Besides, I bet I can get you to love my London. Want to take me up on it?
His London? Sign me up. Yes, I reply. And 2 miles later, here we are, I say, gesturing to the dark blue wooden door into my building. Heath cranes his neck upward.
Fourth floor, you say?
Yes, why, are you going to serenade me? Shaking his head, he laughs.
No, I have a terrible singing voice. I just want to picture you.
Then wait here. You don't even have to picture me in your mind's eye. I'll be at that window, I say, pointing to the one lined with plants, in about 2 minutes. He hums, his eyes narrowing as he calculates something.
Maybe make it 3.
Oh, I ask, arching a brow. What are you going to do for that extra minute?
Give you a gift.
He reaches behind himself, pulls a pair of socks from his back pocket, then dangles them in front of me.
For you.
I'm absolutely enchanted by socks. He hands me the gift, and I unfurl them, delighting at the illustration. It's a woman lounging on a park bench with a book. The caption below her says, "Fuck off, I'm reading." My heart handsprings. Am I truly supposed to not kiss you after this?
I don't know. Are you?
He asks, tempting me. As if I need any more of that. This time with him is nothing but temptation. And yet, we work together. We're competing for the same job. We're rivals. We aren't dating, but we are becoming friends. I hesitate. And in my pause, he holds up a hand as if he's read my thoughts.
You're right. Best that we keep this at coincidental dining, he says.
And touring. Don't forget your promise to make me love this city.
It's a tall order. So we'll start at 11 sharp tomorrow, he says, then gives me a location.
With the socks in my hand, I throw my arms around Heath, my chest pressing against his, my nose sliding along his neck. He smells so damn good. I want to bury my face in his shoulder and kiss him all night long. Seems he wants the same, since he tugs me close, his breath catching as his arms wrap tight around me. And we linger. He's stealing hits of me, too. I wrench away from him, since otherwise I'll spend the night like this, pulling him closer, wanting him again. Bye, friend, I say.
Good night, friend, he echoes.
I run from temptation, up the stairs to my flat and inside. There I go to the window, throw it open, and peer down to the busy street. He's there, phone camera at eye level, snapping a shot of me 4 stories above, a little caught up in him. Or maybe a lot, especially when he texts me the photo he took with the caption, "My London."
Chapter 13. Heath. Hey there, Joe. So, just wanted you to know I was married once and my wife died. But I'm good, all stitched up and ready for romance again. By the way, I've been meaning to mention I was married for 12 years to my college sweetheart. Oh, while we're getting to know each other, as friends and all that, been meaning to mention I'm a widower, and here's a fantastic pub. Let's have a drink, shall we? Shaving the next morning before meeting Joe, I slide the blade along my jaw and practice what I'm going to say, because it would be weird if I waited any longer. It already feels weird, this awareness that I should say something, that she shared with me, and I ought to share with her. I want to. It's not a secret, just not casual conversation. Though, if I'm honest, I haven't minded that it hasn't come up. Still, the longer I wait, the stranger it'll be to drop that intel. Rinsing off the shaving cream in the sink, I return to the rote task. A few minutes later, I pat my face dry, then splash on a hint of aftershave. Will Joe like this rainfall scent? It doesn't matter. That's not the point of today. The point is friendship. And I'll take that. I definitely want it. I grab my camera and a book, then bound down the steps of my flat. On the street in front, I spot a familiar couple out walking, my friend Griffin and his wife Joy. They're munching on pastries and drinking tea. Ah, it's a rare sighting. What brings you back to the homeland? I ask Griffin, as I give him a quick hug and Joy a kiss on each cheek. My lovely bride had a meeting yesterday for her new perfume line. And I thought, why be in Paris alone when I can be in London with her? Joy squeezes his arm. That and the company paid for his ticket and comped our hotel. I laugh. But of course, Griffin is always looking for a deal. I am, and I won't even pretend I'm not. Thanks again for those pics last weekend. I'm definitely going to add the apothecary garden to the tours here. Griffin recently expanded his tour business from Paris to London, so he's on the lookout for interesting places to show off. I'm off to the rookery today, so if you want any photos, yes, yes, and more, yes, especially since it's far away and some customers like that. Some people do, too. He gives a knowing wink. That they do. It's a plan. I say goodbye and walk to the train station near Joe. Since I'm early, I wait on the corner, crack open the mystery Nigel gave me, and pick up where I left off last night, racing through what I suspect is the first red herring about the jewel heist.
The butler did it.
Startled, I jerk my gaze up from the pages. Joe looks entirely impish. You better not spoil this, I say, flipping it closed, giving her a stern warning just in case. She gasps indignantly.
Who do you take me for?
Not a spoiler person, that's for sure.
Good. Because I'm not. I have no clue who murdered the dowager, or lifted the diamonds, or stole the art.
She waves a hand at the book.
And if I did, I wouldn't tell you.
I narrow my eyes. Even if I begged?
I swear, I would never tell you. If you want proof, just ask my friend Emerson. She was dying to know what happened to Han Solo in the new Star Wars.
Jo mimes zipping her lips. I gesture to the station entrance, and we head down the steps. You kept it quiet that he fell in love with Jabba the Hutt's long-lost sister and retired to make babies on Tatooine. Her blue eyes go wide.
You know Star Wars.
Why are you shocked? And yes, obviously I know what happened to Han, and it wasn't a marriage to Jabba's relative.
I didn't expect you to keep up with the latest.
Jo, I'm only 40. I'm not from the Stone Age. She hums low in her throat.
Someone just dropped his age, all casual.
Seems I did. Maybe I'm giving sharing a trial run. Dropping facts like name, rank, and serial number, and then working up to the full carousal of emotional baggage. Should I have held it back? I ask. Made you play 20 questions. She smiles my way as we pass through the barriers, then shakes her head.
No. I like this whole upfront and open thing we have going on.
I tense, knowing I need to say something soon about my history. Like in the next few minutes. But I like this lightness better.
Also, I'm 32, she says,
then bumps her shoulder against mine. As we wait at the platform, my eyes stray to her again, taking in her purple flats, her jeans, and her short-sleeve blouse with its vibrant floral print. You look quite pretty. Her eyes roam up and down my frame. I'm in jeans too, and a simple black polo shirt.
So do you.
Pretty? I ask with a sly grin as the train arrives.
Boys can be pretty, she says.
I laugh as we step through the open doors and find two seats. Of course they can, but I'm not a boy.
I know.
She wiggles her brows.
Do I ever?
And yep, this makes it hard, too, to bring down the mood. The dirty flirting makes me want to stay in this zone.
So, the rookery,
she prompts after the train pulls away.
Why is it your London?
It's a little off the beaten path, over in Streatham Common. It has an interesting history. It's the vestige of a private garden from an 18th century spa. It doesn't get too crowded, and it's lovely, so I think you'll like it. As I tell her more, my pulse builds speed, my skin prickles, and all at once I realize I'm nervous. I want her to like the gardens. I want it desperately. I want Jo to fall in love with this city. But I want to know what she loves too. So I ask her for more about New York, then listen as she tells me about Abingdon Square Park and a bench there by a tree she likes to read under, and then about a quiet cobblestone street in the village, and about her favorite theaters along the Great White Way. Your New York sounds wonderful, I say.
Have you been?
A few times.
Maybe you'll go again someday,
she says with the tiniest of grins. Maybe I will. When we exit the station, we bound up the steps in tandem. That feels a little like deja vu again, but not quite right. I'm not thinking of the past. My mind tugs me back to the church I found a few weeks ago, to the pictures I took, to the way I felt in that hidden alley. That's what this feels like. Full of possibilities. We reach the gardens and go in. Spring is a perfect time to visit. The greenery, lush and dreamy. Jo lets out a delicious sigh, soaking in the flowers, the paths, the foliage.
Stop it, she says. Just stop it.
Stop what? She sweeps an arm out, gesturing to everything.
This is an unfair tactic, showing me something so yummy.
A reaction thrills me. Ah, I told you my London would work its magic. She spins in a circle, taking in the stone path and the burbling fountain. We wander through, reading the plaques about the mineral springs that used to lie underground the grounds. We stop at the fountain, and I ask if she wants a picture of herself in this spot.
Will you be in it?
She asks. To show your friends?
Yes. Would that bother you?
Will they ask who I am?
They will. They're nosy and protective, and they love me,
she says. That clearly means the world to her. Good. And yes, I'll be in it. I want her friends to ask about me. I want her to talk about me. But I also want her to know me. And right now, she doesn't truly know all of me. Why I am able to be here with her. Why I can't stand work outings. Why books are my closest companions. When she lifts her phone to take the picture, I know it's time. It just simply is. I reach for her wrist, curl my hand around it, and stop her. I was married for 12 years, I say. She blinks, jerks her gaze back. Oh, I'm not now. I stumble, the words awkward. I hope not, she says nervously. I swallow roughly, trying again. She died of a stroke. It was swift and entirely unexpected. Her expression transforms, her blue eyes swimming with sadness. I'm so sorry for your loss, Heath. Thank you, I say automatically, but also with relief. How are you doing? A small smile tugs at my lips. I'm fine. Truthfully, it was 4 years ago. I shrug as I let go of her wrist. Really, it seems a lifetime ago. She purses her lips and nods like she's absorbing that last detail.
I have to imagine it would feel that way.
It does. I'm not longing for that life anymore. I've grieved. I've accepted the loss. I say as simply as I can. I want you to know that, and to know how true that is. And I'm telling you because I felt like I was keeping something from you. She's quiet at first, licking her lips.
Where are you?
No, I say. But then I nod. Yes.
Maybe both.
I think I liked that you didn't see that part of me. The widower part, I say.
Why?
It comes out so soft, so tenderly that it's easy to tell her more. You're the first woman. I can't even finish. I don't have to, though, because she reaches for my arm, wraps her hand around my biceps.
I don't see you differently.
You don't? There's more relief in my tone than I expected. Everyone sees me as a project, as the man who lost his wife, who is missing something, who needs to be set up. I don't like being known that way.
That's why you don't play darts or like group things, she says thoughtfully. Those are your reasons.
My brow knits. Reasons.
The other night, Rhea said you didn't go out much, that you had reasons, but she didn't say anything more, and I didn't press.
I tilt my head, surprised she didn't ask. You didn't ask her what those reasons were. Surely she'd have told you.
No, it seemed like prying. I felt you'd tell me if you wanted me to know.
And she waited patiently for me until I was ready. Knowing that, I fall a little harder, a little deeper. I do want you to know, I tell her. I want you to know me, and I also really like that you... Well, that you liked me without knowing my past. This is much more vulnerable than I want to be. But I have to lower my guard, because I want to be with her. She inches closer, her eyes shining.
I still like you.
Her words wrap around me like a warm caress. I close my eyes for a moment, wanting to reach for her, to hold her, to kiss her in the garden, to bring her back to my flat, to touch her, to please her. I open my eyes. Do you want to see more of the gardens?
I do,
she says. I take her on a proper tour, and we shoot photos for Griffin and for her friends, including one of the two of us in front of the fountain. She sends it to them in a group chat. My London friend, she titles it. I'll take that.
Chapter 14. Joe. No! I'm the first to unleash a devastated cry before the credits even roll. Emerson fires next, her jaw unhinged, middle fingers aimed at her computer screen. Are you kidding me? TJ falls onto his back on his couch, flinging a hand to his chest. Oh, man! Shoot me in the heart! Easton simply stares like he just can't believe they broke up the main characters on That's What She Said after a glorious season spent finally getting together. What kind of justice is there in the world of romantic fiction? I pop up from my couch, pacing the tiny living room with my phone, where the four of us are Zooming. What else would we do on a Saturday evening but have a watch party for the finale of the show we've followed together from the first season? They were perfect together, I say, as if the strength of my conviction will bring Carly and Dane back to romantic bliss. They were meant to be, Emerson says, dragging a hand through her wavy brown hair. Clearly, I must boycott Webflix forever.
Or until they move forward with plans to adapt my novel, TJ points out.
Well, obviously, but that's the only exception we're making, I say, shaking my finger at the screen, still livid over that jerk-the-rug-out-from-under-you ending to the comedy. Have you noticed that there isn't really any comedy anymore? Everything is dramedy. What's up with that?
It's a Hollywood trick. Get you to watch by calling it a comedy, and then someone's spouse or sibling or parent dies, TJ says.
I stop in my tracks, but I'm reeling inside. Those hit close to home, the first one and the last one. Perhaps I'm living in a dramedy.
You okay, Jojo? Emerson asks. Is her Zoom frozen? Easton puts in.
I smile apologetically, refocusing on the discussion. You're right, though. You can't just have the good and the laughs and the sexy times on TV or in books anymore, or in life.
Exactly. It's the new storytelling, a little more authentic, going a little deeper, making you think about the chances people take and the ones they don't, TJ adds. Humor and tears, like reality.
I don't think that's such a bad thing, Emerson says.
Well, conceptually, not counting That's What She Said, but for TV shows, even lighter ones, it's good. We're all swimming through bad times to get to the good times. And working out what you're willing to risk on the way, Easton says. He certainly knows about risk, having experienced his fair share on the path to his own happily ever after with Bellamy.
What am I willing to risk?
Sure, I left my safe harbor in New York to come here to London, but is that the same level of uncertainty?
Maybe. Maybe not. Or maybe it's just a risk of a different kind. A gamble on myself, on my career. That's not a bad reason to take chances, is it? I flash back on my day with Heath. Are we taking chances?
No, of course not. We decided not to take the risk of dating. That would be foolish. I'm 1 week into my new job here, the thing I moved for, the thing that makes me wildly happy. I won't chance it for an unproven romance. Besides, one swift look at my dating past tells me this. Romances end, often swiftly. I distill those thoughts into our post-show dissection. Fine, maybe I do like these deep-dive dramedies, but the romantic in me still wanted Carly and Dane together. Emerson lifts a finger.
And that's why you'll tune in next season.
True words, I say.
Easton clears his throat, shoots a purposeful stare my way.
And speaking of going deeper, when are we going to do a deep dive into the photo you sent us this afternoon? The one you said we'd discuss when the show ended. Show's over now, Jojo. Tick-tock.
A smile tugs at my lips as Saturday night unfurls in London 4 stories below me, and my night with my friends starts to wind up. It's only 5 for them, and they're all hitting the New York scene soon, but I'll take this time and cherish it. Thank you very much. And that also means time to dish. That's Heath, I say, of the shot of us from the gardens earlier today. A shot of the risk we're taking. Friendship. Easton gives a tell-me-more look to the camera. TJ wiggles his fingers, beckoning me to serve up the goods. I grab my bottle of wine from the kitchen counter, pour a splash, and do what I'd have done in New York if we were all at Gin Joint or the Lucky Spot. Have a drink, share the deets, tell them my heart. So, there's this guy. 10 minutes later, the debrief is done. I miss the in-person fist bumps and shoulder pats, but I don't take for granted what a gift this is. The chance to talk to them, to matter, to be a part of all their lives. Setting down the half-finished glass, I let out my pent-up breath. So, thoughts? As Emerson paces her apartment, the door creaks open, and Nolan photobombs her screen, flashing a big smile.
I'm here. You're just friends with this dude in the pic?
He asks, cutting to the chase. Well, we started as...
Say it, Jojo. A red-hot one-night stand,
TJ explains salaciously. Like I needed the reminder of my night with Heath. The memory of the fantastic sex sends a fresh rush of heat down my spine. I try to tamp it down, though. Yes, fine, but we worked together, so we dialed it back to friends. And I'd like to have a friend here in London.
Well, that's good, then. You have a lot in common, so it makes sense,
Emerson says, leaning on that practical streak I know so well.
But there's a fine line between friends and lovers,
Nolan adds, his face in the frame beside Em's, practically smushed against it.
And you already sort of crossed it.
But you can go back, TJ chimes in. Just because you slept together doesn't mean you can't be friends. I have friends I've slept with.
Easton arches a dubious brow.
But none of them were your actual boyfriends. You're not friends with your exes, only dudes you've slept with.
TJ nods emphatically.
Well, that's my point. One-time lovers can return to friendship, so it's good that Jojo is trying to be friends with him. But once you catch feelings, that's another story. That's when you can't return to friendship.
Easton gestures as if to acknowledge TJ's point.
Fine, fine, I'll give you that.
Emerson clears her throat. So, as long as she doesn't catch feelings, this whole friendship with the smoldering Brit ripped straight from the pages of Jane Austen will work out fine?
It's possible,
TJ says, then holds up a warning finger.
Just don't bang the hottie again.
Words to live by,
Easton quips. Indeed, I'm doing my best to follow them. Sleeping with Heath again would be a high-stakes gamble now. After all, he might be the start of my London circle of friends. I wouldn't risk my New York crew, so why risk this tender new friendship I'm planting here across the pond? Granted, with my New York group, I never tried to build on the foundation of a one-night stand. Still, Heath and I put the genie back in the bottle this week. He can become part of my new London world, just like these guys are part of my longtime world. But I doubt my father will become part of my London world. He's more of an obligation. That's family sometimes. On Sunday afternoon, I walk to meet him at Fortnum & Mason in St. James. Along the way, I have a heart-to-heart with the young, hurt, angry part of me. The part that has been dormant for some years. The part I learned to live with, thanks to therapy after my mom died. I practice some of the mantras that helped me through that time. The past is the past. Be kind, be gracious, be present. Then be on your way. With my chin up and my best blouse on, I weave through the weekend crowds on the streets of London, jostling elbows, bumping shoulders, and missing every crosswalk sign, it seems. As I wait at the light, a truck swings past me, blowing dust and debris from the street. Stepping back, I cover my mouth as I cough, eyes watering. I turn away from the garbage swirl and into a haze of cigarette smoke. A man in black slacks and a blue button-down puffs absently, gazing into the distance, his eyes annoyed. Maybe he's a banker, working on a Sunday, pissed he's at the desk. I fan my hand in front of my face like that'll dissipate the smoke, then at last I cross the street. As I reach the curb, a harried woman laden with shopping bags rushes past me. I stop short, letting her pass, and she shoots me a searing look. For what reason, I don't know. But I know this. I don't like this London. It's not the London I experienced yesterday with Heath, or the night before with my coworkers. Maybe I've stepped into another half of the city. My father's London. I reach the fancy department store of Fortnum & Mason and head into the tea salon. That's his style. He's very afternoon tea. I find him at a table in the back. He stands, smooths a hand down the front of his crisp dress shirt, then gives a bare smile when I reach him.
"Hello, Josephine,"
he says, then wraps his arms around me in an awkward hug. I accept it awkwardly, too. When was the last time we hugged with any warmth? I haven't even seen him since he visited Columbia a few years ago for a symposium. He lets go, gestures to a chair.
"Sit. Have some tea. Do you still like English breakfast?"
"I never liked English breakfast. I prefer coffee," I say.
"Ah, right. Let's get you some coffee, then, and talk about work," he says.
My shoulders sag. Work. Always work. But then that's all we have to discuss. What else is there? "Listen, Joe, let's talk about the fact that I shacked up with your bestie. What'll it take for you to forgive me?" He won't say that, because he doesn't see it as a transgression. At the time, he saw it as his romantic right, and I doubt that's changed. I open the menu, perusing pastries and tea sandwiches I've no interest in eating, but it's easier to stare at the page. It passes some of the time. When the waiter arrives, my father orders Earl Grey, and I opt for a bubbly water. The waiter's brow knits.
"A seltzer?"
"Yes, please," I say.
"Very well, then,"
he says, and sweeps off. My father arches a brow.
"Seltzer, not coffee? Trying to keep me on my toes?"
"Yes, Dad, it's all about you, my beverage choices." "I already had coffee. I really only like to have one a day."
"Ah, right. You're naturally caffeinated,"
he says, and I wince a little.
"Isn't that what you always say?"
This should warm my heart, this little detail he remembers about me, but it doesn't. "Yes, that's me." I spread the linen napkin in my lap. "So, how are your students?" "That's innocuous enough." He spends the next 10 minutes telling me about the classes he's teaching. The waiter brings our drinks, and my dad lifts his cup, offering a toast.
"To London," he says, "and all the opportunities in front of you."
I tap my glass to his and mutter, "Cheers."
"Now, let's talk about these opportunities," he says. "Tell me the projects you're working on, the auctions. It's a much more complicated world here than in New York, especially for someone new to the city."
"Like you were 10 years ago when you fell in love with my best friend, relocated to London, and changed your life?" "Sure. New York is podunk USA compared to London," I say dryly. My sarcasm isn't lost on him. He sighs heavily.
"That's not what I mean."
"Then what do you mean?"
"It's different handling auctions for Highsmith in London than Bancroft in New York."
I can't resist the bait. "And what's the difference?" He takes a long pull of his tea, then sets it down.
"One is a distinguished auction house. The other is a mere upstart."
I grip my seltzer glass so hard I'm afraid it might break. "I didn't work for a mere upstart in New York, Arthur. I won the Abernathy collection. I competed against Highsmith, Christie's, and Sotheby's, and won. I was hardly at an upstart." He nods like he's absorbing my points.
"That's all well and good, but it's not the same. It's like the difference between curating at the Met versus curating at a local university museum."
I hate when he brings up Andrea, like he has any right to pass judgment on my mentor's choices. She hired me at the Met 5 years ago, then stepped back a few years later to work in New Haven so she could be closer to her family and her grandkids.
"One is always better,"
he finishes. I think Andrea would beg to differ. She's not here to defend herself, so the task falls to me. And damn it, I will do it. He waves dismissively.
"I'm sure she would,"
he says, a little more lightly than I expected.
"She's happy, at least."
At least? Isn't that the goal of life, I wonder?
"But is she fulfilled?"
he presses on.
"Like you'll be fulfilled at this place. I can tell."
There's a kind of warmth in his voice that should be reassuring, but I don't know what to make of it. Or him.
Just don't forget, it'll take perseverance and dedication.
I have both those things, I insist.
Good. Then don't let anything distract you.
I won't, I say. And this lunch can't end soon enough. My bitter mood lingers through the evening and into the next day at work. It follows me like a bad perfume, and I'm not as perky as usual. The morning meeting with the team isn't full of my usual fanfare or spirit, and Rhea tugs me aside after and asks if I'm okay. You don't seem yourself, she says. I'm both embarrassed she noticed and grateful she's so perceptive. Weird day yesterday. Saw my dad, I admit. It's just easier to be open with people. It was a day. She nods sagely. I hear you. Family's rough. My dad and I don't get on so well either. Let's do lunch in an hour. I'll come up with a place. With that, my mood starts to shift. An hour later, Rhea raps on my ajar door. Have you had proper curry yet in London? I look up from my laptop. In theory, it sounds fantastic. In reality, I'm not big on spicy food. She clasps her chest dramatically. Stab me in the heart, woman. I just can't stand feeling like my mouth is on fire, I say, laughing at her antics. She sniffs, so very wounded. I was going to take you to my favorite curry spot. A big sigh comes from her. Fine, then. I'll take you for burgers, you American, she teases. Hey, I love all kinds of cuisine, just not spicy. We actually have some stunning mild curry here. Then count me in. I will try anything. Correction, anything mild. Brilliant. There's a fantastic place around the corner. They can make it extra mild for people like you. Sounds perfect. I grab my purse. Any chance we can discuss the auction while we eat? She beams. I love a working lunch. Over the meal, we talk about her favorite spicy restaurants in London, and after that, the museums here. Have you been to the Tate? Everyone goes, but it's worth it, she says. I keep hearing that. Is it a ruse just to get Americans there? Maybe there's a portal that sends us back to the States? I joke. My, my, someone has an active imagination, she says. I do. I definitely do, I say. About lots of things. Rhea roots around in her purse, grabs something from her wallet, then offers it across the table. Take my membership card. It opens an hour early on certain days for members, she says. And the portal opens then too? I ask with a smile. Of course. I'm secretly trying to get rid of you, she says. I take the membership card and tuck it into my wallet. Thank you. I can't wait to pretend I'm you. This is some serious espionage you're working here, Rhea. Exactly. Don't tell a soul I gave you my card, she says. I'll add it to my secret file, I say. I'll keep it safe and sound, right next to the intel about Heath's dart skills. We segue to other things. The food in New York versus here. How her father wanted her to be a doctor rather than an art specialist. I don't dive into the details of my family story, but I listen to hers. Then we talk about work. I have a good feeling about this, Joe, she says. I have a feeling we can make a splash with this collection. I want it to be a hit in the art world. Is it crazy that I'm so jazzed up about it? She laughs, a little self-deprecating, but like she needs the validation. Just want to be great at my job. I don't want anyone to say I didn't try hard enough or put in the time or the hours. There's a deeper story there, and I suspect it's related to her father. That I can understand, along with her drive. We're going to make it amazing, I tell her, and I believe that we can. All of us. The time with my new friend energizes me for the next few days, powering me through meetings and planning and a lunch with Freddie and Rhea on Thursday afternoon. After I return to the office, Emily buzzes and asks if I can join her in her office. When I arrive, Heath is there.
Chapter 15. Heath. Oh. I didn't expect to see Emily's niece in her office. Sandy's been around a bit since the day her loose lips sunk the ship of my novel, but I haven't interacted with her. I suspect that was for both our benefits, but here she is, parked on the couch next to Emily's desk. She waggles a hand.
Hi, me again. Just doing some observing on, you know, stuff.
Could she be any cagier now? Come on, Sandy. Tell me what you know. Spill the beans. You've got it in you. It can't be too hard to convince her to serve up details, can it? She's got to know something about the promotion. She seems to have Emily's ear. I glance around, but Emily's not here yet, so it's just the two of us. Good to see you again, Sandy. What sort of stuff?
Stuff for my psych internship. Workplace interaction and all. Human resources. Stuff.
She says again, then waggles her fingers like she's sprinkling magic and glitter.
See? I'm learning not to overshare. Confession, I'm an oversharer. Always have been. I meet someone and I'm like, here's my life story.
She brings her hand to her mouth like she's spitting up.
I just tell them everything. I have three brothers. I love border collies. I'm learning to quilt. My last boyfriend was a certified wanker, but I still believe in true love. That sort of thing. But this time I left out a few details about the quilting and the ex,
she says, then pats herself on the back, literally.
See? I'm learning. I didn't say everything.
That's great. It's a shame, though. She's changing her ways right now. And how is school? It seems I ought to at least try to engage her. Sandy chats about her studies until Emily returns. My manager stops in the doorway, seeming flummoxed at first as she regards the tableau. Her niece and me, talking. Yes, I'm fucking personable, Emily. Who would have thought? Score one for the grump. Though I hate thinking of tallying points. I can't stand seeing Joe as competition. I like competition, generally, but not with a woman I'm falling for. A woman I shouldn't be falling for. Maybe seeing her as a competitor will help me stay the course when it comes to resistance. Emily brings me back to the moment, gesturing from Sandy to me.
This is nice to see.
And now I'd like to pat myself on the back, but I don't. Joe waltzes into the office, a laptop under her arm, and heads to the spare leather chair in front of the desk.
Hi there,
Joe says, then turns to me.
Hello, Heath.
Hi, Joe, I reply, keeping my tone professional, even though our inherent friendliness seeps through. Joe says hi to the others. When she sits next to me, in the only free spot, she casts a secret glance my way, a demure little smile only for me. And damn it, my heart races faster at the sight. Is her pulse spiking too?
All right, let's talk about the collection,
Emily says, sitting at her desk, removing her gold-rimmed glasses and gesturing to us.
Joe, you have the floor. Tell me the status on the lot, the marketing, and the expected attendance.
Joe dives right in with the prelim plans, checking notes on her laptop, but Emily's phone trills before she gets far.
Bollocks, my wife. Our dog is at the vet. Let me take this.
She swipes the screen.
1 second, love.
She covers the phone.
Let's make this a great collection. Tell Sandy your progress, and she'll update me. Must step out.
Emily scurries out of the office, asking about the dog's belly as she goes.
Her pup has a special diet,
Sandy explains.
They just changed Polly to a new type of food, so they're making sure she's adjusting to it. Of course,
Joe says warmly.
I hope she's okay. I'll tell Emily you said so, but don't worry about Polly. She's a tough little pom,
Sandy says. I'm sure she is, I chime in. Because of course I want the dog to be fine too. Sandy shifts her gaze to Joe, then rubs her palms.
All right, this will be so fun. Just dive in, both of you.
Joe turns to me, laughs, then goes at it. We trade off, like we're a regular duo, updating Sandy on our fast-moving plans from marketing to client outreach. When we're done,
Sandy smiles as wide as the Thames.
Emily is going to be so happy. She wanted me to convey how important this collection is.
She doesn't say it aloud, but her message is clear. Our role in this collection will define our role in the company, determine if we're VP level or not. Joe and I are both contributing to the project, but at the end of the day, there's only one promotion. Glad to be working on it, I say.
Same here,
Joe says. Sandy smiles, closing her notebook.
That was so much fun, running a meeting. But it must be awkward for you. You're clearly such good mates, here in the same workplace,
she says.
Is it weird working together when this collection will count so heavily toward who gets the promotion?
And yup, there it is, confirmation. This collection might as well be a fight to the finish. I don't even look at Joe when I answer. No, it's all good. Then I leave, because that's a lie, and I hate lying to the woman I can't seem to get off my mind.
Knock, knock.
It's the end of the day and I look up, both relieved and frustrated to see Joe. Mostly relieved.
May I come in?
I gesture an invitation. Always. She enters, tugging the door closed behind her. My skin prickles with anticipation. Is she going to kiss me again? Pretty sure I won't stop her. And that closed door is quite a temptation.
That was annoying earlier. The meeting,
she says heavily, as she sinks down into the chair. Did I annoy you?
No. The situation. The whole, this must be hard. Ugh, no kidding, universe, and fuck off.
I laugh. That ought to be on a pair of socks.
Tell me about it,
she says, slumping her shoulders.
So I came to vent.
This is a vent-friendly zone, so vent away.
I hate feeling like I'm competing with you,
she seethes. So do I admit.
I wish.
She doesn't finish, and she doesn't have to. I know what she wishes. The same as I do. For things to be different, to not be pitted against each other this way. I need this job because the work has been there for me when times have been tough, and I can't risk losing it. She needs it because she moved across an ocean for this chance. To compete with her seems like a cruel twist of fate. I wish it could be different too, I say.
It's like you can read my mind,
she says, with a gentle uptilt of her lips. Maybe because it's in the same place as mine, I say. She nods, then slides her teeth along her lip like she's thinking.
Do you want to go to the Tate tomorrow morning? It's open early for members this Friday. Special deal, the website said. And we can see the Turners before it's too crowded.
My entire soul lights up at the invitation. The possibility. All of it. You're a member? Color me impressed. She leans forward in her chair, cups the side of her mouth, and whispers.
I nicked a card from a friend,
she says in her imitation of a British accent. A grin takes over my face. I see you're learning your way around my London.
Oh, are you a thief too, Heath?
Perhaps I am. Let's steal some time together tomorrow morning. Meet you at 8. I tell her which entrance.
I'll see you on the steps,
Joe says. Then she stands, locks eyes with me, and seems to think for a long time. I don't move. I stay in my chair, waiting, hoping, being tempted. My entire body buzzes with desire, with the wish that she'd come around and kiss me. My bones hum with longing. Throw yourself at me, drag your hands through my hair, cover my mouth with yours. If she did, I'd lift her up on the desk, hike up her skirt and sink inside. Fill her and fuck her and make love to her. The fantasy is so potent, my mouth practically waters for her. Kiss me, Joe. If she did, I wouldn't stop her. I just don't have it in me. Instead, she sighs.
I still want to kiss you, my friend,
she says.
Perhaps my face is an open book, with my lust written in my eyes. I say nothing, offering one more silent plea that she will. But she doesn't, so I lay out the truth plainly. I couldn't stop you if you did.
I should go then.
She walks to the door, opens it, and leaves. I wake at 4, wishing it were 8. The same happens at 5, then at 6. I throw off the covers, go for a run, then shower and get dressed. I'm still early, but I'm antsy, and I can't wait for a morning museum date, or un-date. I don't even care what it's called. I just want it. I head to the museum I know better than the back of my hand and wait on the steps for Joe. As the sun tugs itself higher on the horizon, the lovely American woman bounds up the concrete steps, her chestnut waves blowing in the morning breeze, a simple red dress hitting her knees and flats on her feet, as always. I glance at her shoes. New York taught you that, I suspect, to always wear flats. She smiles as she stands on tiptoes and sweeps her lips over my cheek.
Yes, it did.
My breath hitches as she lingers for a beat longer than she should for an 8 in the morning hello. Then she lets go, and I feel dazed. From that. She is dangerous for my heart, and I can't seem to stay away. She takes a card from her purse and holds it up between us.
Today we are scofflaws as we check out our London.
I lift a brow playfully. This is ours. She bumps her shoulder to mine as we reach the entrance.
Yes, we can share the gallery, I've decided. It's not yours or mine, it's ours.
Ours. How I love the sound of that. How many other things do I want to be ours? I didn't think we were squabbling over the rest of the city, I say as we go inside. She shows the card at the membership desk, and the man working waves us in.
True. But I guess I just like the idea that I can show you something too,
she says. Oh, Joe, you have no idea what you're showing me, what you're doing for me, what these coincidental moments mean. Then let's see our Turners. She grabs her phone from her purse, taps on the screen, then tilts it my way. It's a map of the museum.
I plotted out the fastest route to see all the Turners, since we only have 40 minutes if we're going to make it to the office on time.
Pretty and witty, I say. That's what I said to my brother the night I met you. A crease knits her brow.
About me?
I shake my head as we keep up a good clip toward the first painting. No, before you walked into the bar, you asked about my type. I said I don't have one, but that I like pretty and witty. And fate brought you.
Do you believe in fate?
She asks me the question this time, as we bound up the steps. I believe fate's having a field day with you and me, I say.
Fate is showing us who's boss,
she seconds. Then we practically race through the floor, stopping at a painting of a burial at sea, then a steam train racing through the rain, then a sunrise. It's soft, the colors light, practically shimmering. She sighs almost reverently as she stares.
I don't even know why I like it so much, she says. Maybe that's the true puzzle. It touches me and I don't know why.
The mystery of art, I say.
Or is it the chemistry of it?
She shifts her gaze to me. My skin warms at the way her eyes linger.
Can we ever truly explain why we fall for something? For someone? Sometimes, maybe most of the time, it just is.
My chest squeezes, and my body feels alive as the space between us crackles. Some things just are. I turn back to the painting, gazing at it with Joe by my side. I'm keenly aware of each breath, mine and hers, of how close our bodies are, how near our shoulders, and how alone we are in this gallery. We're the only ones here. And it seems a crime not to reach for her fingers, glide mine across hers. And so I do. Her breath catches, and she grabs my hand. Our fingers thread together, holding tight, maybe to each other, maybe to the chemistry. My heart slams hard against its cage. Perhaps we have both unlocked the puzzle of the Turners. They just make me feel. Or really, she does. A minute later, she lets go of my hand. Good thing, since I don't have the willpower. Quietly, we work our way across her map, stopping, staring, talking again. The clock ticks closer to 9, and soon it's time to go. We need a picture of our London. We return to the sunrise, and I snap a photo of our hands, together. Then we go to the office where one of us will get the promotion the other so badly wants.
Chapter 16. Joe. That weekend, he takes me on a tour of the bridges.
To show you that Tower Bridge isn't the only one,
he says as we meander across Albert Bridge with its pastel greens, pinks, and blues. Heath takes photos of the water, then of me.
Don't pose,
he tells me, a man who knows his mind. What do you want me to do? I ask, a little confused.
Think, read a book, stare into the distance,
he offers. I choose door number 2, grabbing a new romance that TJ told me about from my bag. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Flipping it open, I return to where I left off, the moment when the hero is so twisted up in his feelings he can barely think. I stand at the railing, reading, and from a few feet away, the man I've grown to care so deeply for records the moment. When he's done, he returns to me.
Share this one with your friends. This is how I see you here.
He slides next to me, his shoulder brushing mine. A spark rushes over my skin as I peer at the screen on the back of his camera, checking out the shot of my hair blowing in the breeze, my nose in a book. I feel seen, I say with a smile. He lowers the camera, tucks a strand of hair behind my ear.
You should.
The double meaning flowing between us is almost too much. We reach Southwark Bridge as twilight draws its curtains around the city. Strolling across, I take in its arches, lit up in orange, purple, and pink. They glow over the water, and it feels magical. It feels like a miracle that I don't grab Heath and kiss him, then beg him to take me home. But I don't, because he's fast becoming a part of my life here. And I need this life. I need to feel at home in this still new city. How can I risk that for a kiss?